This is Ron Frenz, comics illustrator, and this is a bumper for the Amazing Spider Talk.
Too many who know the angles, uncover and untangle all the questions and the webs left out to tangle. Be it 1962, or last Wednesday's afternoon, they'll bend your ears with reckless self-abandon. The Amazing Spider Talk. The Amazing Spider Talk. Come swing through the air, sit back and prepare for the Amazing Spider Talk.
Hello and welcome back to the Amazing Spider Talk. My name is Dan Gavostin, and I'm the founder and editor of SuperiorSpiderTalk.com.
Hello, Dan.
Hello, Mark.
Yes, I'm Mark Giannacchio, founder of the Chasing Amazing blog and currently an editor at SuperiorSpiderTalk.com.
Was that a spoiler for me to call you Mark before you intro'd yourself?
Yeah, I wasn't even like, I didn't even take the mask off or anything. Come on.
I'll have to throw up the spoiler warning.
There you go.
The episode.
Hashtag spoiler.
Yeah. Well, thanks everybody for joining us for the special essentials episode of Amazing Spider Talk. Mark, you and I are burning through these essentials. We got, after this one, only eight left.
Only eight.
Only eight, yes. Well, we hope you guys enjoy this podcast and that it provides an intelligent conversation between two fans and collectors as we hope to look at the Spider-Man comic universe in a bit of a bigger picture. Even though this is the shortest issue we're likely to ever cover on this show.
Absolutely. So, and that issue is in this episode, it's Dan's essential pick. It's Amazing Spider-Man number 248. Also known as Thunderball. No. Also known as the kid who collects Spider-Man. The reason I made this joke in the last episode, I keep saying Thunderball because this is actually the backup story the main story, which is a Spider-Man battle with Thunderball from the Wrecking Crew. But the kid who collects Spider-Man, considered one of the most famous comics of all time, written by Roger Stern, pencils by Ron Frenz. Then we will check out the next Flash Thompson's Flash Reviews. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit about the battle that's currently raging on about who is going to replace Eugene Thompson.
Mark, we used to be two kids who collected Spider-Man. And now we're two adults who have collected Spider-Man, which means it's appropriate for us to discuss the kid who collects Spider-Man.
When the road looks rough ahead and you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed, you just remember what your old past said. Boy, you got a friend in me. Yeah, you got.
All right, Dan, this is your pick. You know the drill. Run it down for us. I doubt I'm going to disagree with you on this one, but what makes this an essential comic?
Yeah, you know, this is a tough one to quantify as essential. I mean, it really comes down to our reading of, like, what are the best Spider-Man stories and what are the most essential? Because to me, there's no question that this is one of the best Spider-Man stories out there. But it doesn't really introduce that much about Spider-Man in the way that some of our other books have, whether it be introducing a key character from his story or an element to the character. And it's also because this is not really in the standard convention of Spider-Man stories. It's not a fun comic, really. Quote bunny ears fun, quote unquote fun. Though there is a certain joy to this issue, to seeing Spider-Man through a fan's eyes and getting a kind of a brief glimpse back into Spider-Man's early days. There's some joy to be had there. But for those who have read this book, they know that it is primarily really a full demonstration, you know, as full a demonstration as I can think of the emotional power that both Spider-Man and superhero comics can deliver, you know, other than just kind of like, you know, the generic punching of two characters. But more importantly, I think this is a story that you could have taken Spider-Man out of and replaced him with any number of superheroes, and yet you can't really. It only really works because it's Spider-Man in this story, and at least I think so. I think this is, you know, you could make you. I could see a Flash version of this, but I don't think it would have the emotional power that it does. And then there's just the raw emotional power of this book. I don't think anybody can read this book and not be hugely impacted by it. And whether you think that's it's like fair or kind of like a cheap gut punch, that's up to you. But I find it highly effective and, yes, maybe emotionally manipulative. But I think it works because it really makes you care so much about this kid, Tim Harrison, so much before the gut punch comes. It creates a fully fleshed out character, just in the same lines that Peter Parker was a fully fleshed out character in Amazing Fantasy 15 before Uncle Ben's death. That was another emotional gut punch, as there is here. I think this book is really formally inventive. It kind of is super poetic and charming and constantly engaging. How it uses like this newspaper kind of like B story to tell its story, I think, is really brilliant. I think Ron Frenz, who we've both expressed our adoration for, I think this is like the peak of his artistic work on the book. And weirdly, his most Ditko for a guy who's kind of known to dabble in Ditko's stylings. And I think it really proves that he can alter his style to fit a story. And lastly, it is the biggest testament to how important empathy is to Peter Parker's character. Rather than his guilt, it's his empathy for other people and his caring about other people that really fills out his character in spades. Rather than making him a Batman – not saying Batman doesn't have empathy, but Batman is fueled by his like remorse and revenge. Spider-Man is fueled by, yes, his guilt, but also his empathy and care for the people around him. So that's why I think this is a top story without really getting into the details of what this story is.
Right. Well, I mean, you said a lot there.
Sorry, that's a lot. There's a lot to say for what, like 9 or 10 pages.
No, right. No, but so... you know, I guess I just kind of want to open the discussion. I mean, you know, talk about my kind of just gut reaction whenever someone mentions the story, you know, and I'd be curious to hear from other listeners of ours who are parents themselves, what they think about this. Because for me, I acknowledge everything that you say. I agree with it. I think that this is one of the most elegant Spider-Man stories that's ever been published. Everything about it is spectacular, but as a parent of a young boy, I have a really difficult time reading this story because of that reveal at the end, and you know, like I think because of how fanciful and fun those first few pages are. I mean, you know, this is kind of like, you know, people talk about superhero comics being like almost like a power fantasy and a wish fulfillment for young adolescent boys and girls, obviously, where the cases may be. And this is kind of like that brought to life. This is, you know, this is the kid meets the hero, you know, like this is the ultimate fantasy. Like, you know, if you can't be the hero, you want to meet the hero. And then to just have that twist at the end, that cruel, cruel twist, as someone as with a parent, like thinking of, you know, being empathetic and putting my son in that place and in the place of Tim Harrison. It just keeps me from like, it's not that it keeps me from liking or loving or adoring this comic, but like I'm not going to lie, Dan, like I didn't, I didn't reread the comic for this episode. And you know, I've read it enough times. I know what I, you know, that's neither here nor there, but like, it's hard for me now. I can't. It's just really hard for me on an emotional level. I can't exactly maybe rationalize it, but all I know is as a parent, seeing what happens to this kid is just crushing for me, and it takes me out of the fun that I normally derive from reading a Spider-Man comic, or not the fun, but the fantasy of a Spider-Man comic.
Yeah, I mean it is a cruel thing that happens at the end of this story. I mean, especially like you said, because so much of it is this fantasy. You know, everybody. I mean, I imagine most people that read this are like, I'm Tim Harrison, you know, and maybe that's where I'm coming from. Like,
I mean, that's by design. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. like that's what makes the twist so, I mean, so cruel, but also, I mean, if you want to look up why Roger Stern is considered such a great writer, I mean, stop at this story. I mean, it's like, I mean, like, that's not just great comic book writing. This is great writing, period.
I think I know your answer to this, but I want to ask it. Do you, because I mentioned it a little bit in my intro, do you find this last page reveal to be emotionally manipulative in a bad way? Because all stories are manipulative. Do you think this is kind of a cheap, like, this is how I inject drama into this?
Not at all.
And what do you what do you think earned that for this book?
I think what earns that is kind of the pacing of how the onion and this of the story is peeled back. I mean, it's like you're first kind of like, oh, look, here's this kid who loves Spider-Man. And, oh, look, Spider-Man's visiting him. But, you know, this kid must really love Spider-Man because why else would he be there? And then, you know, he's, like, discussing all these things for him. And then, like, he reveals the identity. And you're like, to me, like, that's, like, the red flag of, like, whoa, what's going on here? What's about to happen? Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and I feel because of how these little things are unveiled at such integral parts and they're done so effectively, it makes the final reveal, for lack of a better word, earned. You know, it's not manipulative because it's like it all makes sense. This is why this happened. You know what I mean? Like I don't think this story would have happened this way without these circumstances being attached to it. So I don't think it's a cheat.
Yeah, and I'm with you there as well. But you know, you can't. It's just so tough to talk about. But to your point about, you know, it not being quote unquote fun or just being difficult to read. Do you think that disqualifies it in your eyes from being an essential? Because to me, that only makes it all the more necessary to be an essential, because it underlines the power that comics can have on their audience, that it can operate in this emotional range. And not only that, but like also the kind of meta text commentary that, like, here's a kid who is, you know, probably terminally ill. And I guess I would say confirmed to be terminally ill in his appearances in the afterlife in future Spider-Man stories. Although I've always been uncomfortable with this book being like canon, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like,
right.
It is canon, but also like, it's weird to see Tim Harrison pop up again in the future because
alongside like Gwen Stacy or something, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's only a testament to this book because he seems so much more real as a character than those characters, because he's suffering failure, you know, like from diseases and deaths that we suffer from in the real world. Nobody is getting dropped off bridges. I mean, not many people are getting dropped off bridges, you know, but at least I hope not. But anyway, there's this whole part of the story that is like that in his sickness, superheroes have brought him joy the same way that in real life, everybody, you know, the power fantasy or the fantasy of superheroes is a kind of respite from pain, and all entertainment can operate this way. Do you think this kind of dark tale excludes it from the essentials list or what?
No, just the opposite. I mean, like, you know, for me, reason why Spider-Man is my favorite character, and we've talked about this at length, is his relatability. And to kind of go to one of the points you were making in your intro, I really can't see any other hero being used in this book besides Spider-Man. I feel like based on what we know about Spider-Man and his empathy and his humanity, and just his ability to connect with regular people, kids and adults, that he is the only one that can be the person who shows up for Tim. And I think like this comic speaks to that relatability and to his humanity better than any other comic, because, you know, when we're talking about, oh, he's got problems, his costume doesn't fit when he's going to go fight the Goblin, or, you know, he has a cold when he's fighting Doc Ock. I mean, like, yeah, those are human foibles and, you know, what kind of, you know, but it's still within the realm of a really heightened fantasy of something that we're not going to see in the real world. Whereas this is something that's very real, and I think it just really reaffirms the relatability of Spider-Man.
I was remembering this issue. I mean, I think about this issue often, but I was remembering this issue when I was reading a recent issue of Invincible Iron Man, where Iron Man visits this kind of cancer ward for children, and you know how you can imagine how Tony Stark would do that. He's very gracious and he doesn't make it about himself, but he is coming in being the kind of flashy, showy superhero that you want Iron Man to be. And I could imagine Captain America doing, you know, going to a hospital and being the patriotic hero. But for me, Spider-Man starts this story off that way. You've got the great moment of him lifting, you know, the Tim's bed, and just the kind of gee whiz wonder of that. I always, as a kid, when reading this issue, would fantasize about that.
And not to cut you off, but we obviously have to talk about how magnificent Ron Frenz is on this book.
Amazing.
I think that's what really sells the humanity of this story as well, not just Stern's, I think, incredibly crafted script. But I mean, Frenz is, you know, it's Ditko-esque, but it's, you know, Ditko, there was a harshness to Ditko, you know, like that, the kind of an uncomfortable discomfort to how Ditko drew Spider-Man and his world. And I think Ron softens that in a good way.
Yeah, and I like the way the point of view of this story artistically. It feels very grounded. Certainly there are shots that are from up high, but Spider-Man is always kind of portrayed as being a little bit larger than life and in some ways creepy too. Like when he's crawling around the ceiling of this kid's room, there is something like a little weird, and I think that may be play into the Ditko-ness of the story. There is something kind of weird about this guy, you know, but still fantastical. And it really, I think you're seeing this a lot through Tim's point of view. And I've always loved that about this story. And to the softness, one of my favorite moments is when they're poring over Tim's book and they find the slugs that Tim has pulled out of the wall. And it's just Spider-Man crouching down to be on Tim's level. And there's so much warmth and kind of giddy joy, like two kids sharing like a trading card collection you know, in that moment, or going over their comic books.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's and yeah, like it's all those little cues, like you mentioned him kneeling down, and it like that's, again, it just, I keep coming back to this idea of empathy and humanity. It's what this book is all about, and you know, just to kind of talk a little bit about the genesis of the story, because I'm always fascinated by that too. You know, Stern has always kind of called this like his attempt to be Eisner, you know, Will Eisner. He's called it an Eisner-esque, like little story. And, you know, because of that, you know, I mentioned that this feels like a Spider-Man story thematically, but structurally and, you know, in terms of its craft, it this kind of goes above and beyond standard superhero storytelling. I mean, it's kind of its own. It almost reads like a little indie comic, you know, that you would see somewhere. And just to kind of add to that, I mean, it's his Eisner comic, and I think Stern kind of had it in the bag and was basically thinking, maybe we could throw it in the back of an annual somewhere. Which, it's like, you know, could you imagine? I mean, putting aside whether annuals count or not, I mean, could you just imagine this, like, backing up, like, you know, Spider-Man and the Punisher versus Doc Ock? I mean, it totally would have been lost. I mean, at least, you know, we joke about it backing up Thunderball, but at least, like, it was part of the main book, and I don't know, it felt more prominent here.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to get back to the idea of the humanity in this book, because I, for me, despite the final page, and we'll talk about the final page in a minute, there's the unmasking in this. I think the way that Ron Frenz draws Peter Parker's face as it kind of comes out of the shadows, to me, I don't think there's ever been a more soulful drawing of Peter Parker's face than the one here. I find it so totally haunting, because he's got his chin held up, like, proud, like, and powerful, but the shadows and the way that the face is rendered, there's something so sad in it that makes him exclusively, like, I guess, I don't know what the word is, but, like, the perfect face for Tim, this, you know, proud until the end, but full of something so sad, like Tim's leukemia, you know. But this face, to me, like, when I think of Peter Parker's face summed up in an image, like, I can think of no better image than Ron Frenz's rendering in this title.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think when you think of the definitive Peter Parker images in Spider-Man history, I mean, there's, you know, there's this, there's maybe the splash page from Amazing Fantasy 15, mm-hmm. and Spider-Man No More. And that's it to me. I mean, those are like the definitive images that kind of like capture the soul of Peter. I like that you mentioned this being a soulful image, because I think it's the right adjective. There's just something kind of otherworldly about it. Like, you know, it's magnificent.
Well, the way that Ron brings shadow into this, like, I think in that moment, but also in this final page, there, Spider-Man swings out of the, you know, I guess the apartment or a hospital room, and lands on this wall where we get the really dramatic reveal that it's a cancer clinic. But there's an image right before that of Spider-Man standing on the wall looking down, where half of his body is obscured, or I guess cast in shadow. And it is such a sad – the body posturing of him standing there looking down, blanketed in shadow, it is haunting. I mean, it's such a sad image to see this character go from this joyous, powerful character to being so deflated and just crushed. I mean – more than any villain has ever done to Spider-Man, this to me is like, I don't think I've ever seen his body portrayed in such a, like, I guess just maybe crushed. I hate to use that word.
Mournful.
Yeah. I mean, it is, and it's such a perfect image. I mean, wow. Just wow.
Yeah.
I just like the idea that Spider-Man as a character can absorb all the pain and sadness for one night from this Tim character, as he does for so many readers, and to have that kind of put out there in this painful story, like, it's weird to confront what a character, like, I guess in such a harsh way, what a character can and is doing for your life. I mean, Spider-Man has been, real or not real, the character of Spider-Man has been there for me in some of my darkest times, and it's so interesting to see that brought to paper through such, I mean, to me, this is masterpiece on art and writing and, like, whatever, give this book all the Eisners. Like, but it is metatextual without pointing, you know, a finger towards the audience and saying, look at what we're doing. And that to me is like just like the best of artistry that there is. So, I mean, to me, this is almost like one of those books that, like, I wish we didn't even have to include it in our essentials list because it should just be presumed essential. And yet it's a B book. It's a backup to another story. Like, who'd have thought?
Well, Dan, good pick. I think you've had a couple good picks in a row. I think I need a bad pick to mix in.
Yeah, well, you're...
I'll come up with something bad.
Being like Marvel 2-in-1?
Yeah, hey.
Hey! It's a good book. It's a good book.
I've defended that to the nth degree. Anyway, why don't we talk some Friendly Neighborhood Spider Talk Members Club?
Dan here. Thank you so much for listening to our amazing Spider Talk show. Mark and I have such a fun time producing it, so we love to know that you guys are out there listening and writing in. As you may know, a few months ago we launched a Patreon account to help us keep the podcast running by paying off the hosting costs and other fees associated with getting all the awesome guests we have, keeping our site running, and building our community. This week, we have one new member to our Friendly Neighborhood Spider Talk Members Club. Keep having to say that. Well, that new member is Jan. So thank you, Jan, for joining our awesome club. Every week we give out free digital comics codes and try to record a members-only podcast just for our members, but we also love to raffle off exclusive prizes to those who've signed up. This week we're giving away commissioned artwork of our logo as penciled by Ron Friends, inked by Sal Buscema, and colored by Edgar Delgado. So let me play with my virtual pachinko machine and see who our winner is. Hold on a second here. Let me get this thing working. And the winner of the commissioned artwork is none other than Carl Reichling. Congratulations, Carl. Check the mail soon and you'll receive your awesome prize. On the next Essentials episode, we'll be raffling off a Batman character, the Scarecrow Funko Pop. That's not the Spider-Man villain Scarecrow, who is a real villain, I assure you. So remember, if you want to join our club and enter our raffle, as well as get t-shirts, coffee mugs, bumper stickers, and so much more in the mail, go to either Mark or I's site and click on the Friendly Neighborhood Spider Talk Members Club banner and join for the low cost of a comic a month. If you consider our show entertaining enough to be worth at least a comic a month, we'd love to have you join our club. Now back to your regularly scheduled program on the same Spider Time and same Spider Channel, which is anytime you want to listen to it and whatever service you're using. So thanks again, and back to the content.
All right, Dan, you might have thought, considering the fact that the first part of our show, we were talking about probably one of the saddest stories in Spider-Man history, that we had Deb Whitman on the show this week. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your way we're talking, for Flash Thompson's Flash Reviews, it's just going to be Dan and I this week, as we are still currently tabulating your votes for the replacement. We're going to be the voting is going to be open until September 7th. You have five choices. I guess someone got left on the cutting room floor. We won't mention who got left out, but you can choose between Lonesome Pincus and Nathan Lebensky, Gabriel Stacy, Deb Whitman, and Swarm. And Dan, what's the early vote look like?
Well, I love that you had difficulty pulling those out of your memory, because that's how forgettable these D-listers are. You couldn't even remember the five. So
I got it.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, you know, it's actually coming in. Everybody has got a vote. Or at least two votes, I'll say. But it is really coming in close between Swarm and Deb Whitman. And actually, I'm checking this out right now, and Deb Whitman is pulling a recovery. It is 15 votes Swarm, 14 votes Deb Whitman. So it is coming in close.
My goodness. I don't know if Deb really knows what she's getting into. If she wins, you know, we'll have to... Hopefully she keeps hanging out at that same restaurant.
Well, I wonder what kind of fascist tactics Swarm is going to employ to pull this one off. I mean, will he send his bees canvassing throughout the country?
Yes, I don't know. Well, like I said on Twitter recently, it's neck and bee right now. It's neck and bee between Deb and Swarm. So why don't we talk about some comics without anybody's crazy introductions. For those unfamiliar with this segment, and really, who is not listening to the show exclusively for this segment? It's 1 minute per person to talk about each of the B books. We're going to start with Spider-Man Deadpool number 8. Dan, why don't you take it away, starting in 3, 2, 1.
Yeah, welcome back, Joe Kelly. You know, after two issues, this series continues to put Spider-Man and Deadpool into interesting territory. In this case, we see Spidey confronting Deadpool on why he killed Peter Parker twice over the past issues, which was pretty awesome that Peter died twice in the series of this book. So Spidey comes back with an awesome new Black Widow-inspired costume, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think by acknowledging One More Day, the consequences of this title seem almost more important to me than those of the main title of Amazing Spider-Man. And it helps that the story has been more fun to read, too. Ed McGuinness is an art god who needs to pencil my dreams, or more apt for this issue, my nightmares, because some of the creatures in this are just terrifying. So this one gets a fan club certified to me. How about you, Mark, in 3, 2, 1?
Well, sadly, Dan, this book demonstrates to me, you know, the pratfalls that come with creators when books are delayed or are kind of taken up with fill-in issues. I probably would have found myself enjoying this epilogue conclusion a bit more if it followed some kind of succession with the previous chapters. But since it was basically 3 months and two issues removed, I had more or less moved on as a reader. With that said, even if the transition was seamless, I did find a lot of the ideas introduced here to be a little confusing and frustrating. The Patient Zero character just did not read as enough of a payoff for me for the storyline that would be going on to set up bigger implications, especially with some of the One More Day being referenced in the earlier Spider-Man chapters. So for me, I'm going to go Puny Parker.
Well, that's sad to hear, Mark. Do you have any theories on who this Patient Zero is?
Zero. And that's not trying to be glib, but no, I really don't.
Me neither.
And I think that might be part of the reason why I was frustrated, because like I feel like the way it was... I'm going beyond my minute. I feel the way it was presented, there was like some kind of inherent assumption that I should have a clue about or speculation about this character, and I have none. I'm just like, what is this? You know what I mean? Like, what am I dealing with here? So
I have no clue myself.
Moving on to Spider-Man 2099, number 13. Dan, why don't you take it away with Miguel O'Hara in 3, 2, 1.
Yeah, I guess for a book that could really have explored some of the interesting precognitive implications of Ulysses, you know, with Miguel O'Hara being from the future and all, I thought Peter David's approach to this crossover was about as boring a dream as one could dream up. Like, it just really doesn't utilize this concept well. I did enjoy the straightforward narrative approach to this issue, as it seems like most of these issues, things are slowly congealing. But I hate to repeat myself, but Peter David sure seems to want to play the long game by not concluding any of his stories in a satisfying way. I mean, none of these have gotten finishing chapters. And, yeah, sure, he's not writing for the trade, which is something we like to be critical of. You know, that's normally a plus. But, man, I would really kill for a 2099 story with a beginning, middle, and end. So I'm calling this one Puny Parker.
All righty, Roo.
All right, count in 3, 2, 1.
Oh, goody, a book that already is suffering from too many loose ends that seem destined to remain untied now gets a tie-in to a larger event book. Yay! Because the reason why I was so invested in a new 2099 book when it came out a few years ago is because I wanted to see how Miguel O'Hara dealt with issues caused by big Marvel event books, not because I was secretly hoping Peter David would get to expand on his story from the 1990s. Anyway... also, to me, the tie into Civil War II felt very tacked on. So it's like, oh, so Ulysses, he can see some stuff from 2099. You should go check it out, man. I mean, Ulysses, he is by far Marvel's most convenient plot device, huh? I'm saying Puny Parker.
He is basically just a plot device.
Yes. Like, never mind. Silk number 11.
All right, count me in.
3, 2, 1.
Yes, the title of Silk has never really blown my socks off, but I do find it to be a reliable and relatable series at the best of times. Robbie Thompson's character of Cindy Moon is solidly written, consistent, and I find her endearing. And the same is true, I think, about the stories themselves. They're never going to wow anyone, but they play out with a lot of heart and take, and while they have some low stakes, they're still somewhat exciting, and they kind of take me back to that like low-stakes early days of Peter Parker's career. This issue, to me, is a great example of all those things. Plus, I think it features Tanya Ford's best art on the title since she picked up the art duties on the series. So I'm not super excited about where it's heading, but I enjoyed this one as a good, you know, pace changer. So fan club certified for me.
Okay.
All right, Mark, I'm giving you the countdown. Silk number 11 in 3, 2, 1.
Well, it sounds like some people liked it, like you, Dan. I actually found the narrative via therapy device that Robbie Thompson used here to kind of muddy the flow of the story and made this whole issue come across as being very herky-jerky. I appreciate that the series is clearly ready to move on from Silk infiltrating Black Cat, but just like the character itself in the story, I'm not entirely sure if the new direction this book is going in is all that compelling or a big enough hook for me. Time will obviously tell, but as a kickoff for a new arc, this story, I feel, needed some more oomph. So I'm going to say Puny Parker.
That's fair. I don't know how I feel about this whole negative zone thing.
Yeah.
Totally not where I would have expected her parents to be, but
no.
Okay.
Yeah.
Peter Parker's parents are S.H.I.E.L.D. spies.
Yes. And they're androids.
There you go. All right. So Spider-Woman number 10, second part of the Civil War II tie-in.
Yeah, 3, 2, 1, Mr. Dan.
I think people are going to be a little surprised by my review of this book because this is the first issue of Spider-Woman that didn't really wow me. It could be that Javier Rodriguez only provided the layouts for this issue with another artist stepping in to do the finishes. You know, but as charming as you know this book is in its writing, I'm not sure I buy the central conflict of Jess being that upset with Captain Marvel, her best friend. I just don't know enough about Jess's history regarding law enforcement tactics to really believe that she'd unquestioningly go to arms against her best friend by this story's end. Still, everything here is what I love about Hopeless. There's some wonderful comedy and great utilization of the most obscure parts of the Marvel Universe. But again, I'm just not buying into the Civil War II elements of this story. So unfortunately, and this is with great, like, tempered nature.
Regret.
Yeah, regret. Because I did like this book, but I think it's Puny Parker for this series.
Wow. Wow. The heel turn has begun.
Oh, God. All right. Spider-Woman number 10, Mark, in 3, 2, 1.
Well, like a day that ends in a Y, you can always count on Dennis Hopeless Spider-Woman to be one of the best things that I've read in a given week. The snark is dripping heavily from this issue as Jessica goes out to explore the truthiness of all Ulysses' premonitions. The difference between this and, say, 2099 is rather than feeling ham-fisted, Hopeless has fun with an editorial mandate and stays true to his characters and the larger narrative he's been building. Of course, the ending, which connects to the events of Civil War II, number 3, for me, at least, hits the right emotional notes and was a great gut punch that counterbalanced the fun from earlier. To me, I'm still saying, Dan, this series can truly do no wrong. I'm saying fan club certified.
I hate to be the guy that's down on a Spider-Woman issue because I love this book more than anybody, but yeah.
I get it, Dan. You're wrong, though.
All right, that's fair.
All right, 3, 2, Web Warriors number 10.
Oh, man, Mark, you're getting ahead of yourself.
You know, just like this book, it's almost over.
The countdown has begun.
Yeah,
before it's due.
3, 2, 1.
Yeah, when a book intended to be an ongoing gets suddenly canceled, you typically get issues like this one, where all the planned stories get crammed into one overstuffed book. That said, there's still a ton of cool ideas and fun concepts here, but the pacing is so fast it's hard to really get invested in any of them. I felt it worked in the previous issue, but as this issue features a number of fill-in artists that change on a whim, rather than just being associated with a particular universe, which is what I thought they were doing when the issue started, and quickly revealed to be not the case as the story continued, it becomes really difficult to follow the actions of this story. Web Warriors, I don't think it's been a failure. I think it's actually been a really fun series. But suddenly pulling a sudden wrap-up is hard to do. So, puny Parker for me.
All right.
Mark, Web Warriors number 10, the penultimate issue in 3, 2, 1.
Yeah, one issue to go, and the clock continues to run out on this series. I'm sure Marvel won't completely abandon the web of life, but it's very difficult for me to be invested in anything going on at the moment, since the entire Spider-Verse premise is on the verge of being tabled for an indefinite period of time. Again, there's some fun to be found here, especially from David Baldion's artwork, although, like you mentioned, Dan, all the other artists really disrupted the flow for me on this book in terms of the visual cues about what I was looking at. Still, this book is so obviously at the end of its run. It's really hard for me to get excited by anything I see on the page, even the fun multiversal stuff for David Baldion. So to me, puny Parker.
You know what this book reminded me the most of was the end of the Scarlet Spider series, where it's
yes.
clear even the editor didn't have the patience to put up with it, you know, and it was just misspellings and incorrect word bubbles and art changes every 3 pages. It's really a shame that these books can't go out in a more, like, professional fashion.
Absolutely agree, Dan. Absolutely. All right. Well, on that note, on a want from Deb Whitman, why don't we go and get into some goodbyes?
Can we go out in a professional fashion?
Yes, let's try.
All right, you can find all of our new Amazing Spider Talk and old Superior Spider Talk podcast at SuperiorSpiderTalk.com or find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and most recently, and our favorite, YouTube, by searching for Amazing Spider Talk. And if you do, please make sure to leave us a rating and comment and let us know how we're doing, and we'll read it on the air. We passed 100, Mark, which means we're well on our way towards
105.
Getting rid of our 6 arms.
There we go.
All right. So if you have any opinions on the comics we discussed today or any questions, please be sure to email them to us at AmazingSpiderTalk@gmail.com. Call us at 9RedGoblin, which features calls from the Red Goblin himself, or tweet at us with OK to print, and we'll address and read them on the air as well.
Yeah, and be sure to check out our Facebook pages and subscribe to our brother podcast, The Ultimate Spin, to keep up with the adventures of Spider-Gwen and Miles Morales.
And don't forget to check out our friendly neighborhood Spider Talk Members Club that helps support the show. And you can win a big prize like today's winner did, that awesome exclusive artwork from us. Next week, Mark, we're going to be talking about Amazing Spider-Man number 17 by Dan Slott and R.B. Silva as we get closer to the beginning of Dead No More. Are you ready for this artist change and this electro-centric book?
Yeah, I'll be interested to see it. So yeah, this artist change that is not a permanent artist change, despite the really bizarre way it was announced.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mark, where can we find you on the internet this week?
Well, of course, you can find me on SuperiorSpiderTalk.com, where hopefully by the time you listen to this episode, I am near the very, very end of the Spider-Man versus Other People's Enemies list. I really hope I'm towards the end. I only got four left. Or three left, excuse me.
You're kind of hedging your bets there, because with four left, you're kind of already approaching the end.
Yeah, exactly. Well, whatever. Anyway, or you can follow me on Twitter at ChasingASMBlog, where I will be talking about comic books and probably retweeting silly things about politics. Jan, where can I find you?
Yeah, you can find all of my stuff at SuperiorSpiderTalk.com. Our team has grown a bunch this past week, so I'm really excited to bring in a bunch of new members. And I wanted to direct everybody's attention to a new feature on our site. We have the Spectacular Spider Snark, which is a new weekly comic strip that we're going to be running on our site, done by friend of the show, Kyle Christ. So check that out if you haven't already. And, of course, you can follow me on Twitter at @SupSpiderTalk.
Awesome. All right, Dan. Well, tread carefully on this last one here, given the story we talked about today.
Yeah, absolutely. Mark, you've collected Spider-Man comics your entire life. That is true, right?
Yes, yes.
Did your Uncle Ben ever help you obtain a rare issue of the series?
Oh, man. Uncle Ben was great. And, he used to take me to these little comic book shows at this little hotel near me growing up. I've talked about it on Chasing Amazing, some of the first posts it put there. It's like, you know, the drill. It's like you got these tables set up and, you got some long boxes set up. And I always felt like you got to go through the long boxes to find the deals, right? I mean, like, usually the stuff up on the wall, yeah, it's like where all the really good stuff is. But, like, some of my best bargains were made going through those long boxes.
Almost should never buy stuff on the wall.
No, unless it's your issue one, right?
Yeah, right. But any other way, that means they know what they've got, and it's going to be marked up.
Exactly. Well, great story. I always like to tell from one of my hotel experiences, the way I came about getting Amazing Spider-Man number 40. Uncle Ben had given me $40 to buy a comic. I went to get the comic. It was towards the end of the day. The guy was charging $50 for it. I asked him if I can give him $45 because I thought I still had a few extra bucks in my pocket. Turns out I only had $40 in it. The guy took it anyway. Yay, I negotiated for the first time. So we left the convention. I'm like ecstatic that I got this comic book, this rare comic book. Uncle Ben is like, sport, look what you did there. And then all of a sudden, this fruit truck barreled out of nowhere, flipped over, and crawling out of the wreckage of the fruit truck was the vendor who sold us the comic. He's like, "You still owe me $10, kid."
Why was he in a fruit truck?
I have no idea. Maybe that's what he did when he wasn't peddling comic books. He was selling fruit. I mean, maybe the fruit from – I got it, Dan. The fruit from the fruit truck was used in the fruit pies that had the monkeys that ate Uncle Ben's face that time. I think that's what happened.
All right.
So it all ties together. It's the mystery. It's the long game, Dan. I'm playing the long game here with the Uncle Ben stories. So the vendor crawls out of the wreckage. "You owe me $10. Uncle Ben steps in front of me valiantly, and the guy took one of the watermelons that fell to the side of the road, cracked it over Uncle Ben's head, killing him with a watermelon, Gallagher style.
That's a hard watermelon.
Well, come on. I mean, they're big and could kill you if they hit you in the head in the right spot.
Is it bad that I'm now imagining an Uncle Ben story where Gallagher smashes his head with a hammer?
Don't beat me to the long game, Dan, okay?
All right.
And Uncle Ben, as he writhed on the ground in pain, was like, "Good-looking comic, sport. And with great podcasts must also come Amazing Spider Talk."